Kunstraum, der Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich.
Dear listeners, welcome to another podcast episode of Im Kunstraum. My name is Frederike Sperling, I'm the new artistic director of Kunstraum Niederösterreich, and I'm very happy to be continuing this podcast format. In our annual program 2023, which works under the motto Sensing the Heat, we focus on the ecological crisis and bring together an intersectional range of perspectives on it. Our current exhibition, Matrix Buddies, kicks off this program by laying the groundwork, if you will. The works in the show are from the artists Agla Bitvertut, Seba Calfuqueo, Katerina Gobi, Nona Inescu, Josefa Ntiam and Sophie Utikal, and variously tackle the relationship between human and nature. In the global north, ever since the industrialization, this relationship has been dominated by the narrative that mankind was the radical opposite to nature. Needless to say, this narrative is more and more eroding in light of freak weather, resource scarcity, and lately, the pandemic. But not only this. Human exceptionalism has been unmasked as an illusion by the very existence of other cosmologies. In their video Tri Tri Co, for instance, the artist Seba Calfuqueo, themselves a Mapuche, illuminates the irreducible oneness between human and nature that the Mapuche, an indigenous people in Chile, have been and still are cultivating and living since centuries. But of course, next to the Mapuche, there are many other indigenous peoples living around the world, sharing cosmological similarities, thus similarities in their way they position themselves in the world. But certainly, they also variously share the struggles in having their spiritual and material livelihoods being acknowledged. In order to add more complexity to this field, we've invited Adson Krenak, an indigenous activist, writer, teacher, and PhD candidate at the University of Vienna. Hello, Adson.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. Adson Krenak holds a degree in linguistics and literary theory from the Federal University of São Carlos in Brazil. He works as a speaker and trainer at the IUCA Institute in Brazil, and as a writer, he won the 10th National Tamoios Award for Indigenous Writers in Brazil. Adson Krenak has been teaching languages, literature, and decolonized history in middle school and high school in Brazil and Austria for 10 years. He has worked in Brazil with the Indigenous Rights Movement, promoting Indigenous cultures and Indigenous literature in schools, universities, and cultural institutes. Adson Krenak works with cultural survival in an indigenous-led organization. Adson, I would like to start our conversation by picking up on the term indigenous. Could you elaborate on what this term means to you and under what circumstances it may be used?
Okay. Thank you, Frederic, for having me here, and congratulations on the show. And it's very important to start with that, because the term indigenous peoples has a history. First, there's one aspect that is to fix, to correct a term that was used by European colonizers to all indigenous people in the world, called Indians. But we know that was an attempt to generalize and to create a label for very, very different peoples and nations. When in the mid of 20th century, indigenous peoples was used in the platform of indigenous global movement to defend our rights, to defend our territories. And we decided, when I say we, a majority of indigenous peoples from all continents, we decided to agree upon this term as a tool, as a political and a legal tool to help the West to create a framework to protect or recognize our rights to our lands and traditional territories. I understand that many of our relatives, they don't like this term because somehow it hides who we are, our differences. But the positive aspect of this term is that way we have been using this term gives us a power, a platform for dialogue to help states, international organisms like United Nations to dialogue with us and to hear our voices.
So it's basically an essentialist term or word, but you use it strategically.
Exactly. That's why we highlight that it's important to use a plural form of mm-hmm. this term, mm-hmm. peoples.
Yeah.
Because indigenous people refers to only one nation,
mm.
only one First Nation, one ethnic group, one Aboriginal group. But when we use indigenous peoples, we are highlighting that there are many different of us, but we share some similarities that, for example, that unite us under this, as I was mentioning, a legal framework to defend our rights to our territories. For example, we are all indigenous peoples all over the world. We are descendants. We are the same people that were here in our traditional territories before the European colonizers arrived in our lands. We also have the same struggles to defend those traditional territories. We have a deep connection and closeness to the land, to the territory. We have a connection that cannot be explained by economical or political or territorial terms. But in general, our connection to our territories, to our land, has a holistic, mm-hmm. Sacred aspect, nature, that highlights our identities, our cultures, and our interdependence with nature, with land, and eventually with Mother Earth.
And I would like to zoom a little bit into that holistic worldview, basically, because, I mean, the backdrop for our conversation is this notion that, yeah, runs through Matrix Bodies, through this show, that, yeah, human and nature are basically inseparable. Would you mind sharing with us, yeah, how this really resonates with the cosmologies of your community of Krenak people?
Krenak people in Brazil share many perspectives with other indigenous people from the Brazilian lands, the biomes we call today, the Caatinga bioma, the Cerrado bioma, the Amazonian, where there is the Amazon forest biome, that we see nature. Let's phrase it in another way around. We see humans as manifestations of the territory, of the land. We are part of the land. Ecology, for example, is not something out there. We are ecology. We are part of that. In my own people, we say we are one, I is we. We is I. Then we share also a concept that of culture and nature that clashes with the West view. For example, many anthropologists, philosophers, and scholars, they have been like discovering, researching, writing about this concept of how indigenous peoples see nature. Actually, let's use nature as opposite to culture. In the West, we say that there is one nature and many cultures. But for us, we have one culture in many natures. What culture is that? The culture of the human Mother Earth, the culture of Mother Earth. All animals, all plants, all stones, living bodies that we see, a river, a mountain, they are part of this only one culture of humanity. For them, for us, they are humans, and for for them, we are humans. We are part of the same family. And we share many natures, many ways to express this culture. And when we see that the world that way, we are not going to destroy it. We are not going to use it, because it's like trading, using, extracting humanity. This sounds very weird for Western ears, because actually is what can save our planet, I would say.
We're gonna dive a little bit into the various facets perhaps of ecocides, but before doing that, I wanted to focus a little bit on the historical roots of ecocides, of the exploitation of nature and humans. And as we all know, the spiritual and material ecosystems of many, if not all, indigenous peoples are under attack today. And this is mainly due to deforestation, industrial agriculture, mining, among other things, you name it. But before we zoom into the details of this, could you elaborate a little bit on where you see the beginnings of this?
Well, thank you for the important question. I'd like to start playing a little bit with the one definition of ecocide. Ecocide is to kill and to destroy the possibilities of lives, many lives. When we talk about ecocide, we are talking about the destroying the lives of multi-species. And all these species, they have an interdependence that makes possible the life of other species. If we engage in an ecocide project, as it, in my understanding, started 500 years ago with colonialism, we are killing the possibility of life of multiple species on the planet. And it's exactly what we are experiencing. It's the appearance of many, many species every day, every year, every decade. We can count the numbers of species that are disappearing. Recently, I read a scientific paper inquiring on the disappearance of birds in Europe, that millions of birds disappeared in Europe. And many of them, probably we never will see them again. And then when this started, 500 years ago, indigenous people tell the story that the end of the world started. When the end of the world that was seen as the same for all species. All species had no hierarchy to see each other. We saw each other as brothers and sisters, as mothers and parents, and grandparents, well, as children. And then we are part of this whole family. But then when this idea that human can be separated from nature creates something that, I don't know where they come from this with this idea of civilization that would be different than non-civilized people, and then these non-civilized people could be enslaved. And this mentality of enslaving people was applied systematically, enslaving animals, enslaving nature, enslaving forests, all types of species. And then this economic mentality, when assumed the predominant position in our society, it started this process that we called colonialism, but colonialism has many children. One of these the children is capitalism. What is capitalism? Capitalism is this mentality that you can accumulate rich, we can accumulate wealth in detriment of other species of life. When money, material things, things that are not even nowadays palpable, we cannot see it, this wealth anymore, when this becomes more important than other things. Recently, I heard someone say that you can define a culture asking who is sitting on the throne. When the Western society decided to sit on the throne, this attitude towards nature, extractivism, destruction, trading everything, then we start the another child of colonialism, that is ecocide. Before, who was sitting on the throne actually was nothing. When no one was sitting, there was no throne. Everyone could have its part in the nature, on the planet, rivers, mountains, the stars, the universe. We saw each other as one, and this the possibility of ecocide or even violence in the terms of using power to oppress others, using money, influence, title, all these systematic ways to deal with the other that we don't understand, create this system that is destroying our possibilities of life. Then what we see what we can predict for the next generations, unfortunately, is a bleak future because of this mentality.
During our preliminary meeting, you mentioned and you shared with me two incidents in your community or near your community in Brazil, and which I think very much painfully illustrates the fundamental linkages between ecocides and the violence on the lives of indigenous peoples. Would you mind sharing them?
Yeah, sure. For decades, my people, Krenak people in Minas Gerais, Brazil, we fought against mining projects on our lands. We knew from the beginning that those mining projects, these extractivist enterprises, would like not only violate the body of a planet Earth, but would violate our sacred sites, would contaminate our rivers, our waters. And then, unfortunately, big corporation, national and international corporation, they kind of kidnapped the state that was supposed to protect our rights, and they allowed those corporations to build, to start these mining operations there. And for huge iron or other minerals mining, you need to build like the dams, deposit for the toxic mud. After a while, we were, of course, we are all afraid of those dams because they were accumulating this toxic mud with many toxic chemicals and mixed with mud and water that cannot be clean. Imagine you produce a material that cannot be absorbed by the earth, cannot be clean. You don't have a solution for that. They made a deposit with trillions of tons of this toxic mud. Then 8 years ago, one of these dams crashed, pouring down these zillions of tons of toxic mud on our river. What Brazilian people call Rio Doce, we call Watu. Watu is our grandfather. This river represents the voices of our ancestors. This river represented the stories of our culture, who defined us. The river is responsible for is the place for our rituals, our ceremonies, our food system, and not only ours, but all our brothers and sisters, animals and plants. When this toxic mud crashed and was poured down, it was not an accident. It was a criminal, irresponsible act instead of protecting the river, protecting our community, they let this happen. And then now, after 80 years, we are still fighting in courts for mitigation. We are fighting for a healthy food replacement for us, because they are sending the companies and the state are sending us industrial food. They are, imagine we used to drink clean, good water. Kids, the elders, everyone could go, like animals. We could go bath and swim and play and do ceremonies and drink the water from our grandfather. But today we have to wait every week. A truck coming, bringing water. We don't know this water, where comes this water comes from. And this is our situation. This happens to Krenak people 8 years ago. But a couple years after that, another crash happened to not far away from our community, involving other international mining company, killing almost 300 people, destroying many, many villages, killing another river. These both rivers, Taparopeba and Rio Doce, the Watu, they are more than 400 kilometers extension. And then imagine how much life was compromised. These two rivers, probably they will need like centuries to recover fully. Maybe never they will be the same again. And then I ask you, we Krenak people would be the same? Our medicine, our stories, our language, there are words in our language that were deeply connected to the healthy and clean and living river. Those words, they also lost the meaning. Then the impact of a crime like that, an eco crime, it's enormous. It's very deep. It's very big. It's huge. And we are afraid that things like that is happening many parts in the world. Will happen much more, because we are experiencing today a rush of mining new minerals. Mining the so-called critical materials, raw materials, or to make possible the green economy, these so-called transition minerals like lithium, copper, etc., that make batteries and electric cars all possible. But we are asking, indigenous peoples are asking, at what cost? What's the cost of new technologies? I think we have, now we can question that. Facing all the consequences of climate change, global warming, so many catastrophes, we have to question, what's the cost of colonialism, capitalism, and new technologies like we are facing now?
In light of this, in light of this background that you've just provided, thank you so much. I would like to focus on your manifold activities, your engagements as activist, as author, as translator, and as educator. I'm wondering, how do you understand your activism, and how does it manifest? And is there actually a distinction between your role as activist, educator, and as a author for you?
Well, I think it's the first time someone asked me that question. Thank you for that. I'm not alone in this work. Indigenous peoples, we have what I sometimes call it the shamanic approach to life. What is the shamanic approach to life? Is our work as a stewards, as a caretakers or caregivers of the planet. We have also the mission to translate the the cry of other species. In many indigenous peoples, the shaman, in Brazil is called pajé, we listen to them as our relatives. If they are crying because the planet Earth is suffering, that's why indigenous peoples engage in this movement that is not only local but global, is not only political but also educational, also as we are used in our communities to live a holistic life with multiple dimensions at the same time. We don't divide in boxes our lives. And then we see every opportunity to share ancestral story. We share animals' perspective, considering that this animal actually is not an animal, but is my relative. It's someone that is concerned about us, the future of the human beings, because actually the cry of nature is about the possibility, the threat on human life on the planet. And then the indigenous activism that I am engaged at Cultural Survival, UCA Institute, and the other friends from all over the world, at, for example, UN forums, we mentioned many events that happened, the COP, for example. We are there to voice this cry. We are there to represent many, many, many communities that they cannot go. Sometimes they send us literally as ambassadors of nature to look, we have to defend our home. Because indigenous peoples are not defend our own territories. We actually don't even have this concept of ownership or property. We are defending a home that belongs to all species, but there is one that doesn't know. Humans doesn't know that they are putting fire on this house or this home, and everybody is going to be homeless, right? Humans are on one boat, everybody. Indigenous, Europeans, Africans, Asians, if we can call them that way, by the continent, we belong to the same boat of humanity. And we cannot consider like one party we're going to sink the boat, other part will be saved. No. If you one part of the boat, it's been destroyed, the whole boat will sink and everybody will lose their lives. Then our work is plural, it's multiple, because we always bring all these voices, not only voices of our communities, but voices of multi-species, voices of beings, worlds that we don't see much in the city, right? Because the city, we see only one world and one way of seeing life. And then we want to bring these methods that other lives, other possibilities matter. And it's important to also to translate that into language or to ways that politicians, lawmakers, and businessmen and the civil society in general can understand. That's why we learn to speak English, German, French, other languages that are not our mother tongues, because we're not afraid of the other. We don't transform the other in monsters. We just wanted to live everybody in a healthy environment, in a house that is good for everyone. This is our message.
Perhaps we could also focus a little bit on how specifically you navigate these different contexts, and also what role translation plays in your activity, in your role as author, as translator, and how this very act of translating is also an act of activism, mm-hmm. if you will?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is to try to walk more than half of the bridge, you know, because we know that every time when we let the others come across the entire bridge for us,
the others is
the colonial powers, mm-hmm. the West, then we go to this other that they have this colonial mentality to translate our world. We understand that translation has some challenges. One of the challenges is loss of meaning, loss of dimensions, context, and the backgrounds, and the loss of really a deep significance of what we wanted to say. But we see translation as a invitation to talk, for dialogue. For example, we are struggling now here in Europe to convince corporations and the European Commission to, let me give a context. There is a new legislation that is a drafted now, but it seems that it's a final draft. They will approve that will be enforced for all European countries. That is called the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. They wanted to give guidelines and to corporations, European corporations, to mine and to work with those minerals and those activities overseas in an ethical way. They wanted to do that, good intention, but you know who they left outside? Indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples are the best stewards, guardians of the planet. I will give you two numbers. In spite of we are probably less than 2% of the planet population, we protect 82% of the biodiversity on the planet. It's our lands. We are very good to do that because we protect our home. And this biodiversity is responsible for the life for all humans, for all species. But those corporations, those politicians, they have the courage to draft a huge document, very difficult to understand, without us. And then we are there, we have been there as a group, indigenous leaders. So we went to the European Commission, we tried to talk to MPs, we tried to talk to other organizations, to corporate people, business people, to look, we want here, we are not against technology. We are here to translate worlds that you don't know, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm. I would like to focus a little bit on what you've mentioned earlier, the notion that in the culture of Krenak people, there is no I. There is basically the individual doesn't mm-hmm. really exist as a sort of concept. Transferring this to the question of the activism or indigenous activism, if you want to use that essentialist term, mm-hmm. Are there any infrastructures or how and to what extent do different indigenous peoples around the world work together, join forces, or are there also frictions between different indigenous peoples? And yeah, how does this activism unfold globally?
Yeah, very good question. Well, I don't know if I can really cover all aspects of this question, but in my answer. But what I can say is, we indigenous peoples are not, we are not essentialists. We don't believe in one single narrative to solve a problem. And the problems that we face, they are always, plural, has multiple aspects. Then it's very important that the dialogue is very important to talk and to to understand that we are not in the different sides. We are looking for, we are working to defend the same rights, the territorial rights. A territory for indigenous peoples is not a political territory. Territory is a landscape, is a part of the planet or the land that accumulates stories of multi-species, stories of animals that every season pass there. They migrate. They are like nomads, like humans. They visit those places for rituals, for love relationship rituals, for hunting, for many rituals. The animals they have this plants as well. Plants they visit different places. There are always seeds traveling, winds in a perfect harmony with the land. And many times, of course, crashes happen and frictions. And because life is that way, it's like how we make other stronger. And when we challenge our views, our concepts, unfortunately, this is thanks to many anthropologists. They have this sense that indigenous cultures, they are stable. They are frozen in time and they don't change. In many people in the West, they have this perception as well, that indigenous cultures, they never change. They are always that way. No, our cultures are, if I can use this term, our ways of knowing, living, understanding, translating is always changing all the time. As, for example, for the Munduruku people, for very short time ago, they women were not allowed to speak outside of the community, only inside of the community. But the pressure from the state power, the cooperation on the territories, the communities, the men, they understood that, look, we need the women. And also many women leaders inside of the community, look, our men are not doing a good job. I think we have to take over. If they took over, and now we see many, many Munduruku leaders, also Klenak leaders, they are women. We have other genders also represented in these new leadership roles, because we are here to protect the land. We are not here fighting for power.
Maybe we could finish our conversation by the question, what role you think literature can play in activism or as activism. And also, I think you brought a poem to our conversation, and perhaps we could end up on that note.
Yeah, amazing. Well, literature is in my heart, because literature is kind of one of the art that is in love with storytelling, right? And indigenous peoples all of the world, we love stories. We love storytelling. We are stories. Every person, every thing you see in our communities, in the world, in this universe, is a story being told, a story being shared. And literature has this power to disconnect people from the to-do list, from the mechanical world, right? And then literature has this power to activate our imagination. And imagination is a form of knowledge, very, very precious. Literature has a power to unlock secrets of the other world, also the future worlds that we dream of, the dreams of the land, the dreams of other animals, other species, can be translated into literature. Then I think literature is kind of one of the master narratives to reach out to all type of people on the planet, because everyone children, elderly people, everyone like a form of literature. Even people that don't read books, they love to listen to a poem. They love to listen to beautiful text transformed into a song or a composition. Then literature kind of is present in many, many aspects of our lives. And I believe that literature is powerful because of that. And I love to read my relatives from other countries. I'm sorry. And one of them is a poet that I have been reading, especially during this pandemic, the last 3 years. She's a Cree, from a Cree indigenous nation in US. Her name is Joy Harjo. And she's, by the way, she's a laureate. She has many prizes, won many prizes for her work as a poet, as a musician, composer, and is an amazing artist. And the poem helped me a lot because during the pandemic, I lost many friends, many relatives that were not protected by the Brazilian government during the pandemic. Unfortunately, they passed away. They couldn't survive the virus. But this poem, for example, that was my prayer every moment. And then through this poem, I kind of was visited by them. I was visiting them through this poem because I think poems are kind of prayers that allow us to visit people that we love. Right? And the poem is Remember. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon, who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn, that is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away to night. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father, he is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth, we are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life who are all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind. Remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. Remember, you are all people. And all people are you. Remember, you are this universe, and this universe is you. Remember, all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember, language comes from this. Remember, the dance language is, that life is. Remember.
Thank you very much, Edson Krenak, for those poems, for this conversation. Thank you.
You are welcome. Thank you too. And I wish you all the best. Rere Borum.